It's midnight GMT. Hello, I'm Rob Young, and this is Business Matters on the BBC World Service. This hour, live from London, Tokyo, and Toronto. Apple says sales of its iconic iPhone have fallen sharply. We'll ask what it means for the tech giant that redesigned consumer devices.
This is a company very much in transition. The smartphone sector itself is declining, so they've had to come up with other ways to make money.
Also this hour, the world's most important central bank could be about to cut interest rates, allowing Donald Trump to say he was right and the bank was wrong to keep putting them up last year. And we'll hear why the changing face of men has hit sales of razors. That's all in Business Matters after the news.
I'm Stuart McIntosh with the BBC News. Hello. South Korea says that North Korea has launched several unidentified projectiles from the Hodo Peninsula on its east coast. The South Korean military says it's monitoring the situation. Last week, North Korea fired two short-range ballistic missiles from the same area. Here's Laura Bicker in Seoul on what's known about the latest launch.
Certainly, the South Korean military put out an alert, but it does take some time for them to analyse just how far these missiles flew and exactly where they ended up. What we do know is North Korea issued through state media a warning, what it called a solemn warning, to South Korea. It said that South Korea was double dealing. It accused the administration here, President Moon's administration, of talking peace while acquiring new high-tech weapons and taking part in joint military drills, which are due to start in just a few weeks' time.
President Trump has taken part in events at the historical settlement of Jamestown in Virginia, marking the 400th anniversary of the birth of democracy in America. Black political leaders from Virginia State and other Democratic Party lawmakers boycotted the event in protest at what they said were recent racist remarks by the president. The governor of California has signed a law to prevent President Trump taking part in the state's Republican presidential primary next March, unless he discloses his tax return. Here's our US correspondent, Peter Bowes.
The governor is Gavin Newsom. He's a Democrat. He has signed this measure that requires presidential and candidates for the governorship in California, future candidates, to disclose their tax returns in order to be listed on the state's primary ballot. It's called the Presidential Tax Transparency and Accountability Act, and it demands that presidential candidates disclose 5 years of their federal tax returns to be included in the primary election. And, of course, President Trump has repeatedly refused to do just that, to reveal any of his tax returns.
Health officials in the Democratic Republic of Congo say a second case of Ebola has been detected in Goma, raising fears of a rapid surge in casualties in the densely populated city. The latest victim is believed to have travelled to the city more than 2 weeks ago. The head of the country's Ebola response team, Jean-Jacques Muyembe, said measures were in place to control the spread of the disease.
We already have response teams in the field to first of all disinfect the victim's home and the health centre through which he passed. We've established a list of high-risk contacts, and as early as Wednesday, these contacts will be vaccinated with the vaccine we have here.
So far, the outbreak has killed more than 1,700 people in eastern Congo. This is the World News from the BBC.
Hello and welcome to Business Matters. I'm Rob Young. On the programme today, we'll find out what Apple's doing about falling sales of its key product. We'll also talk about the expected cut to interest rates in the US. It'll be the first reduction in more than a decade and could affect the whole world. And the global trend for beards has hit sales at one of the world's biggest sellers of razors. We'll take a look at beards through the ages.
If we go back to the 80s with designer stubble, well, of course, a stubbly face was the sign of the yuppie, wasn't it? The up-and-coming Gordon Gekko-style executive.
I'll be joined throughout the programme by two guests on opposite sides of the world. With us today, we have Ralph Silver from the Silver Research Network. He's in Toronto in Canada. Evening, Ralph.
Good evening.
We also have Yoke Ishikura, a serial company board member, a professor emeritus and member of the World Economic Forum's expert network. She is in Tokyo. Morning, Yoko.
Hi. Welcome. Thanks for having me.
Welcome both to the programme. The technology giant Apple says it sold $26 billion worth of its iconic smartphones in just 3 months. That is an awful lot of devices. But sales of the iPhone were down sharply, down 12% from the same period last year. That's a big fall, particularly given the company's historical reliance on selling the handsets. And for the first time in 7 years, phone sales represented less than half of the company's overall revenues. The company is offsetting that by selling various digital services such as Apple TV and music. Well, the BBC's Dave Lee in Silicon Valley has been talking me through the company's performance.
Well, we've known the iPhone has been a product in decline for quite some time because the smartphone sector as a whole has been in decline. Apple, of course, has tried to kind of mitigate that as an issue by raising the price of the iPhone to make more money from the ones they do sell. But despite that, the iPhone now accounts for just under half of Apple's overall revenue, which is the first time it's been less than half since around 2012 when the popularity of the iPhone was really taking hold. So it's a bit of a milestone moment for the company because the iPhone up until now has been their primary way of making money, selling that hardware with new versions every year to keep people coming back.
So if this trend continues then, how big a problem is this potentially for Apple?
Well, you know, I wouldn't call it a huge problem. Reason being is if when you look at the other parts of their business, it's performing very, very well. This is a company very much in transition. As I was saying, the smartphone sector itself is declining, so they've had to come up with other ways to make money. And while Apple's profits are still down compared to where we were last year, it does look like that is turning around. So the transition is generally working. And what the transition means is a bigger emphasis on services, so things that you do with your device, whether it's a subscribe to music service or the upcoming TV service they've got, or by using things like Apple Pay, the contactless payment services. You know, Apple's doing very, very well there. As well as that, the wearables sector has, frankly, has exploded in the last year. More than 50% growth there. And that wearables sector includes the Apple Watch and also AirPods, the wireless headphones. So they're making up for the drop in the iPhone's popularity by big, big gains in other areas.
Let's talk about China. It is an important market for Apple when it comes to selling its products, but also the iPhone is assembled there. What has Apple said about the impact of the trade war between the US and China?
I think you can summarize Apple's thoughts on China with one phrase. It's, you know, it's bad, but not as bad as it could be. They saw a 4% sales decline in China in the last quarter, in this quarter they're reporting now. But that's a big improvement on where they were the previous quarter, where it tanked by a lot more. And so Tim Cook, the CEO, was telling investors they consider that a marked improvement on where they were. The big problem in China for Apple is people buying less of the hardware, although many people are blaming that more on currency fluctuations, though we should mention there has been a bit of a anti-American technology sentiment in the country because of the trade war between the US and China and also these constant disagreements over Huawei.
And is there a sense that Apple is no longer that creative, dynamic, market-changing company that it used to be? And that is perhaps best demonstrated by the fact that it is no longer the world's most valuable company. Microsoft is, and many people may have assumed that Microsoft was a company on the wane.
Do you know, Rob, I answer the question about Apple's creativity approximately every 3 months when these earnings come out. And I think, you know, there is that vision, isn't there, or that view at least of Apple not reaching the creative heights of the Steve Jobs era. And that's I guess that's true. You know, it's a different type of company, still making huge amounts of money, still coming up with new projects, just not, you know, necessarily as groundbreaking a deal as the iPhone. But that was a once in a generation technological shift, really.
Dave Lee there in the United States. Well, let's talk to Ralph Silver in Toronto and Yoko Ishikura in Tokyo. Ralph, a 12% fall in sales is pretty big, and it's certainly not a trend that is sustainable, is it?
It certainly is big, but let's not forget that they did make $26 billion on it. So it's not an insignificant amount of their business. It's still big. However, if you look at Apple over the past 3 years, you've noticed that they've actually put in significantly more resources into their iPad teams, as well as their corporate and services teams, than they have, in fact, their iPhone. So they're a very smart company. I think they figured that there was going to be a downturn, and they've already staffed up the other areas to make sure that they can capitalize on the other areas. So I have to say, I'm not really concerned about Apple making money. They're going to continue to make money, and they're going to move as where and when they need to.
Yoko, each new generation of smartphone from whichever company doesn't really seem to be a great leap in terms of technology from the previous one, does it? So perhaps that is one of the reasons, along with the high cost of the smartphones, that people are reluctant to shell out for them as regularly as they once were.
I suppose so. But iPhone still is perceived as a good, you know, premium product. And if just listening to the report earlier on, I just realized myself that I do have the iPhone 10, but on top of that, I have like Apple Watch and AirPods, so I'm an iPad and, you know, Mac Air and things like that.
Wow, you're
like
a fully signed up member of the club.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm not too interested in the new model of iPhone because it doesn't seem to be new as such anymore. And yet, I think it's Apple still has the position of being a creative company and probably much more full line than just iPhone.
Ralph, Yoko there used the word premium. Do you think smartphones are still a status symbol as they have been in many years recently, or are they now increasingly just a utilitarian device?
It's the latter. They are, in fact, utilitarian devices. And the reality is that in North America, an iPhone can cost $1,000. $1,000 is a lot of money. And the incremental increase in technology that Apple's introducing isn't justifying it when the devices that we currently have are actually very, very good. The technology is incredible. It works really, really well. And in the early days, we used to get new phones because it was either too slow or it wasn't working properly. And that's no longer the case. And Apple knew this was coming. And every technology company knows that this is coming. And that's why they've beefed up their services area. And of course, you look at companies like IBM or Cisco, they've all gone through this exact same transition. Technology gets better, people stop buying it more often because they don't have to.
And so, Yoko, should the price really be going up, or should the price be falling?
I think the price should be falling. And I think that's part of the reason why the people do not buy anymore, because they realize that they don't, you know, it doesn't add too many features. And yet, you know, we use smartphone like pretty crazy when it comes to the use of it.
How many hours a day, Yoko, do you reckon you're on your phone?
Oh, I don't even know. Probably 20. I'm trying to stay away from my phone.
Doesn't leave much time for sleep.
Yeah, because I heard that, you know, a lot of people just, you know, check the iPhone or the smartphone when they wake up in the morning or in the middle of the night. And I thought, I wrote the column saying, don't sleep with your smartphone.
Ralph, how many hours a day do you look at your smartphone?
You know what? I'll tell you exactly. It's about 4 hours, because I do turn my phone off at night. I absolutely do. And I throw it away. And the reason why I don't have it on my desk most of the day is because I can't do anything else if it's there. So I can't get any work done. So for my sanity, I have to actually put it in a different room.
Very sensible. Hope you've done that right now.
I have.
You're with Business Matters on the BBC World Service. The US Central Bank could be about to announce a decision which in some quarters may cause it some embarrassment. The bank has just started discussing what should happen to US interest rates, with the expectation that it will cut the cost of borrowing for the first time in more than a decade. President Trump has already made clear what he thinks the bank should do. Before boarding a noisy helicopter, he had this to say.
The Fed moved, in my opinion, far too early and far too severely. It puts me at a somewhat of a disadvantage. Fortunately, I've made the economy so strong that nothing's going to stop us. But the Fed could have made it a lot easier. I would like to see a large cut, and I'd like to see immediately the quantitative tightening stop. For them to have done quantitative tightening and also higher interest rates simultaneously, I think was a big mistake.
Well, a cut to rates could prove embarrassing because the central bank put rates up four times last year against the advice of the president. The bank's chairman, Jay Powell, has been on the receiving end of endless presidential barbs, but has made clear he won't give in to political pressure. A cut seems to be on the cards now because of economic uncertainty. Dr. C. Fred Bergston is a former US Treasury official and founder of the Peterson Institute in the US. He also worked in the White House as an economic affairs assistant to Dr. Henry Kissinger. He told me more about the Fed's thinking.
The argument for an interest rate cut is to take out insurance against a future turndown in the economy. There's a lot of debate about whether it's needed. One could argue it both ways, but the case for it is to limit the risk of a downturn generated by the risk of trade wars, lagging investment demand, and other possible forces leading to a slowdown.
Isn't it embarrassing for the Federal Reserve, given that it spent last year putting interest rates up four times?
The Federal Reserve is implicitly acknowledging that it acted prematurely to raise interest rates. The European Central Bank, of course, did the same thing, had to reverse course. Central banks like to return to what they call normalcy by getting away from the excessively easy monetary policy that's existed ever since the financial crisis. But, yes, they've now been proven wrong, at least in part. I think this downward move may be only a one-off shot. It'll depend what happens over the next few months, whether they repeat it with future interest rate cuts. But for the moment, yes, it's a modest policy reversal.
Does this decision to cut interest rates, if that is indeed what the bank does, essentially say to Donald Trump that he was right and he is calling on the Federal Reserve to make a big cut to interest rates? So do you think the bank will be under pressure, although it is independent, to listen to him?
It is certainly embarrassing for the Fed to seem to respond to President Trump's call for lower interest rates. As I said, they're doing it for economic reasons. There's a widespread view now, not a total consensus, but a widespread view that taking out insurance through an interest rate cut is a wise thing to do. But yes, it appears to some to be a response to President Trump that would not be in keeping with the Fed's mandate and self-image of political independence. So that, too, is a bit embarrassing for them. Now, he wants much bigger interest rate cuts than they're likely to do now. But again, they could go down further over the next few months. The market, in fact, expects that. If they do, it will be further vindication of Trump. I'm sure most of the people in the Fed hate that, but to their credit, it won't stop them from doing what they think is right in substantive terms.
You've said an interest rate cut would be a useful insurance policy to have because of the trade war which is raging between the United States and China. But do you think there is perhaps a U.S. recession on the way?
There is some fear that a recession will take hold, not immediately, but at some point out in 2020. As I said before, it's not only the fear of the trade war impact that's motivating this move by the Fed. There are some other signs of slowdown, particularly in private investment, and there are some forecasts that the economy will slow down, the rapid pace of consumer demand will ease, and that we could slow even into a recession sometime within the next 1 to 2 years. There is not a consensus view that the Fed cut is desirable or certainly necessary. But as I say, it's insurance to try to limit the risk that a recession would come into play sometime in 2020 or even out in 2021.
Fred Bergston there from the Peterson Institute in the US. Well, let's have another word with Ralph in Toronto and Yoko in Tokyo. Ralph, what do you make of the situation the Fed has got itself into with President Trump?
Yeah, I don't agree with what has just been said. I don't think the Fed made a mistake. I think the Fed made some assumptions. They made the assumptions that it was going to be normal operating modes. And since that rate change, since the rates were put up, Trump has actually picked a fight with China in terms of a trade issue there, and Brexit has come up. So the situation has changed. And that's the reason why they have to make the change, not because Trump is saying anything. These are some of the smartest people in financial services anywhere on the planet. And they're not going to listen to Trump if it's going to hamper the economy. And I think that's exactly what they're going to do. They're going to do it completely independently.
Jocko, what do you expect the global impact to be if the Fed does cut rates? Might, for example, Japan follow suit?
I doubt it. And I think it may be good to prevent the U.S. recession, because right now Japanese companies are suffering a little bit because of the trade war and China. And so that's, even though they're doing quite well, they may be suffering a little bit more. And when the U.S. is getting, I mean, U.S. economy has been so strong so far, even though we talk very often about, you know, it's coming, the recession is coming and so forth. But if it does happen, then I think the Japanese economy will be hurt quite a bit.
Ralph, you're very much on the side of the Federal Reserve when it comes to its public spat with Donald Trump. But do you think that central banks, not just in the US, but elsewhere, that their much cherished political independence is at serious risk?
Oh, I agree with that completely. Not just that, but the judicial system as well. We're seeing a lot more politics going into areas that should have no politics whatsoever. So I would agree with some people who are stating that 90% of the Fed is independent, and that number keeps deteriorating year after year. So it's a scary progression that we're going on. But right now, I still think they're in the vast majority independent, and hopefully they'll stay that way.
If you're only 90% independent, you're not really independent, are you?
That's a good point. It's kind of a binary thing. You're right. But I mean that there's certain members in the board there who are not independent, who are more political, but the vast majority of the board is still independent. But of course, as time goes by, more of those independent people are going to be pushed out.
Right. Let's talk about hotels. They are meant to be a home away from home, where everything you need is where it should be. And that, of course, includes all the toiletries you'd expect to find in the bathroom in individual small plastic bottles. Well, perhaps not for much longer. The chain Intercontinental Hotels Group has said it's removing miniature toiletries from its rooms for environmental reasons, making it the first global hotel brand to undertake such a move. Business Matters regular Maya Van Rossum is campaigning to have a green amendment to the US Constitution. What does she make of the hotel group's move?
I think it's about time that the hotels stop putting those miniature toiletries in our hotel rooms. They're environmentally very damaging, and frankly, people don't really need them. I know myself, I often take them home, and where do they end up? They end up in the cupboard or in the drawer, and they never get used.
Is it not a shame, though, that people can't swipe toiletries when they check out of a hotel? Take a little memento. No.
Of course not. There are better mementos than shampoo that you're never going to use. And of course, if somebody ends up at a hotel and they've forgotten something, they can always go down to the front desk and they can get the shampoo or the conditioner or the soap that they need. But we don't really need to provide these throwaway plastic bottles that are so harmful to the environment.
What do you think should replace these miniatures? Because when many people do stay in a hotel, they haven't necessarily got toiletries with them.
I'm actually standing in a hotel room right now. I bring my own toiletries because I prefer to use my own shampoo and conditioner, my own body lotion. So I bring my own. But I think that also having those refillable large containers make a lot of sense, and they work very well. And frankly, I find that the hotels that use those refillable containers tend to provide a higher quality product. So I'm more inclined to use it. And we also have to remember, when it comes to these refillable plastic bottles, right? It becomes a lot of waste that ends up in the landfill. The fact of the matter is, to make the plastic bottles requires a lot of devastating environmental impacts, like fracking for natural gas, which is happening in communities across the United States of America, and polluting the water and polluting the air and resulting in climate-changing emissions. So it's a heavy environmental footprint to use those silly little plastic bottles when there are other options available.
Many hotels have been trying to do their bit for the environment for many years, haven't they? For example, putting signs in the room saying, if you don't want us to replace your towels, please hang them up. We'll only change them if you put them on the floor. By their very nature, hotels do have a large impact on the environment.
I'm staying in a lot of hotels, and often there is that sign which says, if you don't want us to wash your towels, hang them up. And when I do that, I come back to my room inevitably at the end of the day, and what I find is they actually have replaced them with fresh towels. So they didn't follow their own instructions. I think a lot of this is marketing.
That was Maya Van Rossum there. Yoko Ishikura in Tokyo, yes. Do you use the toiletries that hotels supply or do you take your own?
I take my own. And I used to use the hotels, but then I figure that particularly for shampoos and, you know, conditioners, I have to, it's for everybody. So it's not necessarily for, you know, type of hair that I have. And so I heard from my hair stylist that I'd better bring my own. So that's what I do. The only exception is when they have a very good brand that they have, I take some of the other miniature bottles and use it when I'm on the road.
Yeah, you do, and the big swipe as you check out then. You fill your bag.
Right, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And so that's what it is. But I think it's a very good move in a sense of if you are trying to get rid of these miniature bottles, because the plastic bottles is environmental, you know, doing a lot of damage. It's such a small quantity and small volume with a lot of quantities, and it just doesn't, it makes the supply chain and the production very complicated.
Yeah, Ralph,
as a matter of fact.
Sorry, Ralph, do you think it is a wise decision to remove the miniatures, or perhaps in high-end hotels, would people think they weren't getting a premium service?
I think that they need to change the plastic bottles to glass bottles or something that's easily renewable. Absolutely, I agree with that. But the fact is that you can't take fluids on carry-on luggage when you get onto an airplane. So I do use them. Not the fact that I need any fancy shampoos, because I just basically shave my head. So that's much easier. But nonetheless, you can't expect people to bring it if they're just doing quick trips, which is what I normally do. So yes, okay. It's very, very, very helpful. But what I've noticed is that a lot of hotels, in the lower ends especially, have like them built into the wall in a
they
bag.
They do indeed. You Ralph, your coat for now. Thank you. You're with Business Matters. Hello and welcome back to Business Matters with me, Rob Young. There are an estimated 1 billion people in the world with a disability, and many of them are under or unemployed. The International Labour Organization estimates the unemployment rate for somebody with disabilities is as high as 80%. Back in January at the World Economic Forum in Davos, an Irish activist, Caroline Casey, called on 500 companies to put disability on their board agendas before the end of the year. So how many have actually signed up, and what is it like at work for people who are disabled? The BBC's Stephen Ryan has this extended report.
When it comes to finding work, people with disabilities face considerable challenges. In the United Kingdom, only 51% of them have a job. That's compared with 81% of people in the general population. So I've come to visit one small business in North London, which is bucking that trend.
Hello there, that's Jasmine. She's been quiet at the moment. She's a lab retriever. She's 8 and a half. You wouldn't think by looking at her. She's changed my whole life.
Jasmine is one of three guide dogs in the production area at the Clarity Factory. The company makes soap and luxury bath products, sold under various brand names in supermarkets and department stores. It's offered employment and training for people with disabilities since 1854. In fact, their founder, Elizabeth Gilbert, lost her sight at the age of 3 due to scarlet fever. And she believed in enabling blind people to earn a living. Today, out of 100 workers, more than 80% have some kind of disability. For people like Ricky, having access to the support available at this social enterprise was quite a change from his previous factory job.
I've been here 15 years. I've done sort of everything from topping to bottle feeding to putting them through the labeller, packing.
What was it like on your first day? What was it like coming in to the factory for the first
time? When I first walked in, I knew straight away it's not the same as a mainstream workplace. As soon as I walked in, it was like a family environment.
What kind of supports do you need when you're at work?
When I was at my other place, to read letters, like to ask someone sighted, it took ages. Whereas if you needed something like that here, it'd just be done, no problem.
Just across the production line at a standing desk, I meet Mike, who's hard at work processing order dockets. You have a screen in front of you. How does this work?
It just magnifies. Because I'm severely sight impaired, I'm not able to read a thing on this particular invoice at all.
How long have you been using magnifiers like this?
Probably about 20 years. Without this technology, I wouldn't be able to work. I wouldn't be able to read anything. Even some of the products I collect from the shelf, I have to put under the magnifier to read sometimes.
So if you look at the temperature dial in reception, it currently sets about 27 degrees. So it's a pretty hot day. And the production line, they've taken a quick heat break. So we thought it'd be a good chance to catch up with Diane Chung, who's the marketing manager here at Clarity. So Dan, you're holding a soap dispenser. You can see the green braille dots on the dispenser.
I'm actually holding a bottle of the Soatco Eco Hand Lotion. The Soatco brand itself has got the braille across the front of it. It's very tactile. A lot of people just love picking up the bottle and just feeling it. It's truly representative of our workforce. About 25% of our staff have visual impairments, but 80% of our overall staff have a disability of some shape or form. So we call ourselves a pan-disability organisation. And it's from factory to finance, actually. It's not just here on the shop floor. This includes people who are in sales, in marketing and IT, that we're helping people not only get confidence and skills in their job, either they'll use it as a stepping stone to move on to positions outside the organisation, or they'll stay with our company as a job for life because they're not capable or able to find a job anywhere else.
As a social enterprise, what comes next? Because you're putting your money back into the business. But in terms of getting people to invest in your business, you want to generate money. So what does the future hold?
We don't take donations as an organisation currently. We don't fundraise either. So we actually only can keep our doors open if people buy our products. For BECO, for instance, which stands for Better Considered, we calculated that if every bathroom in the UK put BECO in the bathrooms, we'd create 45,000 jobs for people with disabilities.
What do you think other workplaces could learn from how you operate here?
I think they could realise that social enterprise is a scalable proposition, that actually it is possible to employ people with disabilities and run a full-functioning organisation that has brands in high street retailers and department stores like Fortnum & Mason.
So that's the experience of one company in London, showing the value of having people with disabilities in their workforce. And while that's one positive example, globally, if you have a disability, you're 50% more likely to experience poverty. Caroline Casey is a social entrepreneur and disability campaigner. In January, she spoke to business and political leaders at the World Economic Forum in Davos to make the economic case for more inclusive workspaces.
Business is the most powerful force on this planet. There is a very clear economic case and a return on investment for business. And it's about brand differentiation, next generation talent and acquisition. This is a 20% of our global population. Business would be crazy not to engage with it. But there are serious social consequences when it doesn't.
Caroline is one of the founders of the Valuable 500, and she's getting businesses around the world to commit to putting disability inclusion on the agenda at company board level. She told me it's crucial to get top bosses involved to deal with the obstacles to work for people with disabilities.
56% of our leaders have never spoken about disability at board level. The Valuable 500 is asking 500 CEOs around the world to put disability on their board agenda and create a collective massive influence to reverse this. And what we will be asking that group of 500 is to look at how we are integrating disability performance into business. That's good for society, that is good for business, and I think more importantly, good for people with disabilities and their families, because disability is something that will touch every single human being at some point in their life. The Valuable 500, I want to be very clear, is not asking 500 CEOs around the world to simply employ people with disability. We're asking them to see the value across their full supply chain. Our biggest challenge right now for business to do is, do you already know who's in your business? Because 80% of disability is invisible.
Caroline Casey there, ending that report from Stephen Ryan. Well, with us on this edition of Business Matters, we have Ralph Silver from the Silver Research Network in Toronto and Canada, and Yoko Ishikora, a serial company board member who is in Tokyo. Yoko, you're on several boards, aren't you? Is this an issue that gets discussed?
We do. I mean, at least I know one or two companies where we discussed at the board and asked to we do have the percentage requirement of that for the company to employ disadvantaged people, and it has been like 2-point-some percentage, and it's been going up, but that is an issue. And I'm also aware of a couple of companies which makes very clear effort of trying to present these disadvantaged people at the big conferences and things. And I think they consider it as a part of a diversity and inclusion. And we, with D&I, have been the big issue here in Japan quite a while. And it's not just related to the women, gender, or, you know, nationality. I think that includes disadvantaged. But we did have a scandal at the government offices because they tried to report the number of people who they hire as a disadvantaged, and they just kind of made it up a little bit larger than it's actual. So that became a very big scandal about a couple of years ago. And if the government does it, you know, what does it mean for the other companies? But that has been the issue, though.
Ralph, what about the companies that you work with?
I have to say that I think it's morally reprehensible. And the idea of employing people with disabilities so that you make it a profit center through marketing and public relations, to me, is an ethical line I don't think that should be crossed. You hired these people because they can do the job. And the reality is, maybe you need to do some more things. Maybe you need to add some more elements to your place of business. Maybe you need to give them more help. But they're going to be able to do the job. So that's the point. And I think that the way to go about this is that I think in Canada, we've done a little bit about of this as well, is we went through this whole process of affirmative action back in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. We need to do the same thing. The idea of not hiring somebody because you got to add a new, you have to give them a special desk or whatever the case may be, or you got to allow their dog into the area, that we should name and shame that.
It's discrimination, right? And in many countries is illegal.
It is. And it needs to be stopped. But we need to encourage businesses to actively pursue people with handicaps instead of waiting for them to come. Because there's the other side of the coin is that people with disabilities sometimes feel that they shouldn't apply for a job because they'll be turned down for it. And that's totally wrong.
Yoko, do you think it is depressing that only 100 out of 500 companies have signed up to this pledge that Caroline Casey was mentioning in that report to try to really get this issue on the agenda at board level?
Well, I think it's depressing to the extent that it's such a small percentage. But at the same time, you know, it makes the issue visible. And whenever the issue becomes visible and more companies are aware of it, what other companies are doing, I think that will be a good start. I don't think it's necessarily that bad.
So, Yoko, what do you think governments around the world should perhaps be doing about this?
I think that the government, I'm not really sure about the other government, but the Japanese government makes sure that they make the companies to employ a certain number of people among the total number of employees.
So some kind of quota.
And they have to pay the penalty if they don't follow. And I think they do get the subsidies if they go beyond that level. And they started including the mental health as well very recently. So I think that's a very interesting move. I'm not really sure how far it would go.
Ralph, do you think governments should perhaps be getting a bit tougher about this?
Absolutely. I do, however, believe that the vast majority of Western governments already have laws in place. The problem here isn't so much the laws, because I think they're generally in place. It's the policing. They need to go out and they actually have to actively find organizations that are flaunting these laws. And in my opinion, anyways, name them. If you told me that a specific company was discriminating against people who have handicaps, I will not shop there. But I don't know that most of the time. So if we tell the public, look, this organization's doing a poor job in this area, we'll make sure they pay because we won't buy their products. And I think that that's what needs to happen.
You're listening to the BBC World Service, the world's radio station. A very good morning to our listeners in Singapore on 88.9 FM. And a special hello to our late night listeners in Prague on 101.1 FM. Let's find out what other business stories are gripping various parts of the globe now. The BBC's Monica Miller joins us live from Singapore. Morning, Monica.
Good morning.
So the United States is urging South Korea and Japan to try to settle a pretty serious, it seems, diplomatic dispute. So Japan has reined in exports of high-tech goods to South Korea, and this is over a dispute that dates back many, many decades.
Yeah, this is a pretty serious issue, and the U.S. is reining in. Just as we heard our top story, there are concerns about North Korea again. And one thing that the U.S. is keeping an eye on, even though this is a trade issue we're talking about, is the relationship between Japan and South Korea. The U.S. has military bases on both, and they rely heavily on both of these countries to get along and support them in their initiative to keep North Korea in check.
Is there much comment about the U.S., which of course has sparked a trade war with China, still raging, telling other countries not to wage trade wars?
Yeah, it's a very good point. And so far this morning, I haven't seen much about that, although it, you know, certainly has crossed our minds here in the newsroom. You know, but what this really goes back to, as you had mentioned, a dispute over World War II when Japan had occupied South Korea from 1910 to 1945. And during the war, were some serious issues of forced labor by the Japanese, comfort women that have been discussed over time, that really there hasn't been much, wounds that have been healed over this. But this does now spill into the business industry. The Japanese feel that they had paid compensation, and this was a settlement that was reached in 1965. However, the South Korean top court says that this is an issue that hasn't been resolved. Japanese companies have been asked to put together a fund and to compensate the relatives of these, the survivors of the victims of this. But Japan says that this is a done deal. This is an issue that was resolved already. And so Tokyo is now, as this continues on in the courts, has decided to rein in exports on high-tech materials that South Korea really depends on, particularly in the semiconductor industry. These are rare rare chemicals that they need to make all kinds of things from, like, example, the screens on your iPhone. And so this is really going to hit that semiconductor industry hard.
Monica, stay with us. I want to come back to you on another story in a moment, but we have with us on the line from Tokyo, Yoko Ishikura. Is this a big issue for Japanese companies, Yoko?
It is. And I think, you know, we had so many things, and, you know, we say the Japanese government said it's settled and the Koreans come back and so forth. But it has taken the little bit different level. And I think we're also talking about the security issues rather than just in addition to the trade issue. So that is becoming quite serious, particularly in the face of North Korea. And I think that's why the Secretary of State Pompeo has decided to mediate between the two.
What do the Japanese people make of this? The two countries could perhaps decide to end their military intelligence sharing relationship because of a dispute that dates back to the Second World War.
I think that remains to be seen. It's not. We don't hear too much about the public opinion on that point. We talk about the Korean, the trade issues and also North Korea, but not too much about the military, collaboration and so forth.
Monica Miller in Singapore. I've got here a copy of the front page of the South China Morning Post. It has a story that says flat buyers are rattled by the unrest, pulling out, forfeiting millions of dollars. So what is this story about?
Yeah, Hong Kong's red-hot real estate market is one of the most expensive in the world, is now starting to see signs that these violent protests are really starting to cool it down, particularly in the retail sector. Hang Lung Properties says that rents for high street shops on Fashion Walk, Causeway Bay, they're expected to fall up to 10% this year. I was watching some of the protests over the weekend, and you could see Chinese shoppers walking just as the police were about to approach the protesters. And so a lot of these stores, and this has gone on for about 2 months now, have had to close up shop during these disturbances. So this is really starting to take a toll on the economy, not just in the retail sector, but overall, according to a senior Hong Kong government official.
Interesting that there's an economic impact on this, as well as the potential reputational impact there has been around the world.
Indeed, indeed. We've been told by analysts here in Singapore that they've gotten many phone calls recently about moving money and potentially moving operations our way. But at this, it seems to be speculative at this point.
That's fascinating. Thank you, Monica. That's the BBC's Monica Miller there in Singapore. Ralph Silver, what do you make of that last point that Monica made there, that after weeks and weeks of unrest in Hong Kong. Some companies are thinking about relocating to other big centres in Asia.
I think that's natural for most businesses to think, oh, we see that in other places, in the UK with Brexit, and in Canada when Quebec wants to talk about leaving. So it's a natural progression. The number that will actually move, however, will be very small. But what this does do is it gives these businesses an idea of exactly what the opportunities are elsewhere. And sometimes it turns the other way and these businesses start becoming more global in nature. So there could be a positive to this as well.
Now, have a listen to this. This has been a familiar refrain on many a TV ad break over the years. Well, that particular razor company was bought by the consumer goods giant Procter & Gamble for $57 billion back in 2005. But P&G has just had to write off a big chunk of that. Part of the reason is the shrinking market for razors and blades. Sales have been falling, partly because of greater competition, but consumers in developed markets in particular are shaving less frequently as social norms change. In our office, certainly you'll see many more men with beards or a few days of stubble than you did a few years ago. Dr. Alan Withy from Exeter University in the UK has been researching the changing trends in facial hair from the 1600s onwards. So when I spoke to him, I of course started by asking him about his own facial hair.
I'm absolutely the worst poster boy for my own project because I'm bald and beardless.
Right. Why, though, do you think men are shaving less?
Well, it's been a pattern, really, over the last 6 or 7 years that beards came back with a vengeance, seemingly across the world. And one theory, of which I happen to be an advocate, is that facial hair often becomes an issue when masculinity is somehow being challenged or redefined in some way. And I think you can certainly see echoes of that in, you know, the current gender climate that we live in, and the way that gender boundaries have been redefined. So it seems that facial hair is often returned to almost as a constant of masculinity.
So men want to have a beard or stubble or whatever to prove their manliness, or what?
I think it's more subtle than that. It's almost, yeah, it's a reassertion of masculinity. But I'm not saying that individual men get up in the morning and think, you know, I need to reassert my masculinity today, I'm going to grow a beard. But it often in the past, certainly in the 19th century, for example, masculinity was under challenge in a number of ways. And one of the responses to that was that men grew massive beards. And it is also interesting, for example, that beards have often trended when we've had female monarchs.
It's not just about beards, though, is it? Because it does seem that in many workplaces at the moment, it is perfectly acceptable for a man to go in unshaven, to have stubble at work in a way that it perhaps wasn't acceptable 5 or so years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we don't have to look too far back, actually, for when it became quite popular again. If we go back to the 80s with designer stubble, well, of course, a stubbly face was the sign of the yuppie, wasn't it? The up-and-coming Gordon Gekko-style executive. But there have been various rules and regulations governing facial hair. And I think even as late as the 1970s, there were companies that would not accept men with beards. But if we go back to the 19th century, one of the arguments made in support of growing a beard, which there were many, was its health benefits. And it was advocated for example, men who worked in dusty environments, men who worked on the railways, down in coal mines, stonemasons, that they very much should grow a beard because it was nature's filter and it would catch all the dust and the germs and stop them invading the throat and the neck. And even clergymen, public speakers, were encouraged to grow beards to protect themselves from the elements.
So it waxes and wanes then. So companies that make razors may be selling fewer of them at the moment because trends have changed. But are you saying that trends will change again and they will sell more razors?
Beards come and go, and they come and go in various incarnations. So just one thing I've been looking at quite recently is beard styles of the second half of the 19th century. And we tend to think of the Victorians having massive beards. But in fact, one of the most popular styles was called the chin curtain, which is basically a strip of beard running from the sideburns underneath the chin and back up. And that still requires much of the face to be shaved. So what I'm actually noticing is that the market often proves quite resilient. And where one thing maybe takes an impact, as we've seen razor sales were hit, something else arrives to supplant it. So you get instead a growth of beard products, beard oils, beard softening products, moisturisers and such.
Dr. Alan with you. Well, let's talk to Ralph in Toronto and Yoko in Tokyo. Well, I didn't shave this morning, so I've got a bit of stubble. Ralph, what's your current facial hair situation?
I have a requirement. I have to keep it at 3 millimeters. That's a law that is in my house that my wife has actually imposed. So I have no choice. I have to use clippers pretty well every day to make sure that it's at exactly 3 millimeters.
Wow. And does she check?
No, she looks at me. If I actually go a day or two and I just let it grow a little or grow a little, she'll tell me. But I actually prefer to be fully shaved. I used to shave my head every day for 25 years and shave my face always. But she says that she doesn't prefer me that way. So I don't think she likes my face very much. But now that the beard's a little
sure
bit gray, it's kind of looking a little salt and pepper. So I'm not too. It's not a big problem right now, but it does take a lot of maintenance.
And Ralph, in a work and in a social context, are you seeing more men with more facial hair than you did a few years
ago? Yes. Oh, absolutely. But there is a difference. There's facial hair and there's trimmed facial hair. It's like you can't just let it grow. You have to trim underneath your neck. You have to make sure that part is shaved. You have to make sure it's clear cut. Everything has got to be right. So it's probably more work to make yourself presentable in a business environment with stubble or beard than it is to just shave the entire thing off.
Yoko, is this something that men in Japan are doing as well? Indeed, is it acceptable to go to a Japanese office when you aren't cleanly shaven?
I was just trying to think of anybody with beards that I saw at the office, and I can't think of any. So beards are not that big thing in facial hair. And at the same time, I think the trend is going towards the much more sort of clean-looking, presentable man. And we call them ikemen. That's good-looking man. And we have, I believe that the cosmetics and personal care products for men is increasing very, very rapidly because the young men want to look good. But not necessarily sort of the masculinity concept is not that strong here.
You disagree with Ralph's wife then? You don't like a man with a bit of stubble?
Right.
There'll always be sales for shaving companies in Japan then. This is just part of culture in Japan. People just don't like facial hair.
No. I mean, that's what it is. And it seems like that their facial hair or hair of any kind in Japan is much thinner than the others. And so you don't see too many people with the hair on the legs and things like that. So that's some things that may be related to the physical and the race and so
okay.
forth. But, I mean, good-looking men are always welcome. And, but the definition of good-looking and masculine is somewhat
Indeed.
Different here.
Yoko Ishikura, Ralph Silver, thank you both for your time. Your company on this edition of Business Matters. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. I hope you can join us then. Bye-bye.
How do geckos walk up walls and across ceilings? How do beetles survive in one of the most arid places in the world? And how do humpback whales power their enormous bodies through the sea? I'm Patrick Ai, and those are some of the questions I've been answering in my podcast, 30 Animals That Made Us Smarter. But the answers are actually just the beginning. The podcast is about biomimicry, solutions to human challenges that have been inspired by nature, like how the gecko's feet might help us grab hold of space debris, how beetles are teaching us better ways to collect water, and how the bumps on humpback whales' fins could make wind turbines more efficient. In every one of our short episodes, we look at a new animal and a new solution. There's lots for you to explore already and plenty more on the way. That's 30 Animals That Made Us Smarter from the BBC World Service. Just search for 30 Animals That Made Us Smarter wherever you get your podcasts.